Today I'm speaking with Philip Bromberg. Philip is a licensed clinical psychologist, executive director of the Swedish Network for Psychedelic Science, and chairman of the Osmund Foundation. He's also a therapist in the upcoming psilocybin study at the Karolinska Institute, and has a private practice where he helps clients with integration of and preparation for psychedelic experiences. It was great speaking to Philip as he explained the current state of psychedelic research and what modern psychedelic therapy actually looks like in practice, as well as potential risks and upsides of using these intriguing compounds. I took a back seat for most of our conversation, but there was some interesting discussion later on in the episode when we spoke about the dangers of interpreting a psychedelic experience as ultimate truth, which I suspect the critical rationalist in the audience will appreciate. On another note, I've stopped putting my donation segment in the middle of the episode, and I urge anyone listening regularly to Do Explain to consider becoming a monthly Patreon supporter at patreon.com/doexplain. Also, giving the show a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, provided you think I've earned it, and retweeting episodes is very much appreciated. I hope that 2021 could be the year when we make this platform grow exponentially so that I can progressively keep improving the content, reach a wider audience, and keep these episodes coming. All right, enough of that boring stuff. I wish you all a happy new year. And I hereby present the lovely Philip Bromberg. All right, so I'm here with Philip Bromberg. Philip, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's somewhat a special episode this turnaround because not only will I release this as the first new episode of 2021, it's also the first time after having done this podcast for a little over a year now that I actually have a Swedish guest on. So, Philip, I'm very honored and it's about time, I think.
Yeah, well, it feels natural to speak English since in my field in psychedelic science, I've always talked a lot to international people. And there's one of the challenges of this work that I have been doing has been to really find a language in Swedish to talk about this research. So in a sense, it's more natural, or it comes more natural to me to talk about it in English.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I'm married to an American lady, and so I speak English most of the time anyway. So I find myself always having to do the same thing where, yeah, I can't find the words. I have to make up new words in Swedish because I just, you know, lazily translate them from English. So,
and I can relate to that. I have a British girlfriend. I speak English every day as well, except on Sundays. We have Swedish Sundays.
Do you have like a snazzy way of saying your name in English? Because I thought I would introduce you in Swedish because it's fun to finally have a Swedish guest. But how would I refer to you? How would you refer to yourself when you're abroad?
I usually say Phil because otherwise people get confused with the pronunciation of Philip. It's a very right. International name, but the pronunciation is very Swedish.
But do you say Bromberg or?
Yeah, I say Bromberg.
Yeah, okay. I do the Christopher Lovgren. Everything just sounds a little bit cooler in English. So I thought we could start then, Phil, with you giving just an outline of who you are, what you're interested in, what it is you do, and. Yeah, then we can continue from there.
Sure. So I'm 32 years old. I'm a clinical psychologist. And my main interest during my career in the last 5 years has been the field of psychedelic science, and specifically psychedelic psychotherapy and how we can help people using psychedelics in a safe and efficient way. So I started a nonprofit in Sweden when I was studying to be a psychologist about 5 years ago, which is in Swedish called Nätverket för psykedelisk vetenskap, or the Swedish Network for Psychedelic Science. And I've been doing nonprofit work with with this organization trying to promote research in the field of psychedelics for the last 5 years, bringing researchers to Sweden to give talks at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. We organized a scientific conference in Stockholm 2018 called the Colloquium on Psychedelic Psychiatry. That ultimately led to an offer of a donation to fund psychedelic research in Sweden, which led us to start a foundation called Osmond Foundation and a pharmaceutical company called Osmond Labs, and get approval for the first psilocybin study in Sweden, which will begin after New Year's, so around the time when this episode is aired. So I'm involved there as a therapist, and I'm also working long-term with raising funds for psychedelic research and for bringing psilocybin to market as an approved medicine, open science and nonprofit.
Yeah, that's really cool work you're doing there. And if I've understood it correctly, you also have a private practice on the side?
I do, yeah. So on one hand, it's a great way to get more experience with understanding psychedelic experiences and what they do to people, while still remaining in a framework that works in Sweden. So I see people who have had psychedelic experiences, and I talk to them about the meaning of that experience and how they can translate the psychological insights into behavioral changes that improve their life. Also, I think a service which is very much needed, because the level of knowledge about psychedelics in general in society is not very high. So we need to, as psychologists, get more information out there and help people make sound choices with regards to their minds and behaviors that are risky, because taking psychedelics outside of a clinical context can be very dangerous.
Yes. And that's something I definitely want to touch on later, seeing how it's very in vogue right now, the term psychedelics, and it's sometimes touted as somewhat of a miracle cure, or people can get the idea that this is something for everyone and you can just take it and it's going to change your mind for the better. And so, I want to get to that a little bit later. But can I ask you how you got interested in this in the first place? What was it that kindled your interest?
Sure. So back when I was a teenager after high school, I traveled to Peru, actually, to improve my Spanish. And I worked there as an English teacher for a couple of months. And there I stumbled over ayahuasca. I just heard about it when I was there and participated in a ceremony, because I was curious and interested. I had a very strong experience that was difficult for me to really make sense of.
Mm.
So I wouldn't say that it changed my life, but it was a very intense experience that made me curious. And years later, 10 years later, when I was studying to be a psychologist, I got really interested in the science and the treatment of addiction, which led me to read a book by Gabor Mate called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And I got really fascinated with his view on addiction and on spirituality as well. So I started looking at interviews and talks, and then I stumbled over one specific video. I still remember which one, where he talks about ayahuasca and his own work with helping Canadian heroin addicts get clean from heroin with the help of ayahuasca. That, of course, made me very curious. As I was working in addiction then on the side while studying psychology. So then I got in touch with all the modern psychedelic research using psilocybin to treat addiction, using MDMA to treat PTSD. And I was just amazed how this research could be going on and helping patients that are otherwise deemed as treatment resistant. And no one's saying a word about it in my class or in around me. I didn't know anyone who knew anything about this. So I read every article that I could find. And then I wanted to talk about this. I wanted to know more. So that's how I ended up starting the Swedish Network for Psychedelic Science as a way to just find other people, other psychology students, other people in the healthcare system familiar with this work.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it's somewhat analogous to my own journey for starting this podcast, how it fascinates me how curiosity is often the main driver for innovation and how, yeah, you just wanting to know more about this and understand it and speak with other like-minded people about it. The best way for you to do that was to, yeah, I'll do it myself. I'll create the format or the base for us to interact about these things. And I feel like I did a similar thing with the podcast where I now have an excuse. I'm curious. I love to have interesting conversations. And yeah, now I have an excuse to reach out to people like yourself and have a platform to explore these topics. So it's, yeah, it's nice.
It's a beautiful aspect of the internet. I don't think the Swedish Network for Psychedelic Science would exist without the internet. And I don't think much of the psychedelic movement and psychedelic research would exist if it wasn't for the internet. The first thing we did was to start a Facebook group, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then that Facebook group just grew naturally because this was something that people around me was interested in, even though nobody talked about it. And then after we had after we saw how this Facebook group just expanded, we figured we have to take this to the real world. And then everything followed, you know, in small steps, but in a steady pace. And things just sort of grew and grew, and now we have 800 members in the organization.
Yeah, and the first Swedish study about to happen. So, yeah, it's amazing, Philip.
Yeah.
So, I think that most people have heard of psychedelics, but I thought that it could be useful still if you could just briefly explain to us what we are talking about when we're referencing psychedelic drugs. And I also think it would be cool to start off the conversation by painting a picture of the history of psychedelics, both psychedelic science and then, how it affected the culture and how it led up to the point where we are today.
Sure thing. It's a big topic, but I'll try to summarize. So psychedelic substances are naturally occurring substances that are found in nature. The most typical ones are psilocybin, dimethyltryptamine, and LSD, and mescaline. And they act on a specific receptor in the brain, the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor. And they have a very strong effect on consciousness. It changes perception in a profound way and the experience of reality. Mm. At the same time, they seem to be non-toxic and non-addictive. So on a physiological level, they're quite harmless, actually. They seem to have the effect on the mind that they dissolve the sense of self and create what is referred to in the literature as a mystical experience, which is very similar to the mystical experiences that have been described in religious literature. They also overlap in some aspects with a psychotic episode. Right. So, for example, the experience of the self dissolving is something that might be experienced in a psychosis as well. So those are what is usually referred as the classical psychedelics. But when we talk about psychedelic therapy, we sometimes apply a more wide term or description. Since the word psychedelic in its very basis means mind manifesting, it was coined by the psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond in a letter to Aldous Huxley in the 60s. If you only say that a psychedelic is mind manifesting, then you can also include drugs like MDMA or ketamine that have a different mechanism that don't seem to target the same receptors in the brain, but can be used in a therapeutic and safe way to treat different psychiatric conditions, and can be used also to explore the mind and help individuals grow psychologically.
Would you include cannabis in that wider category as well?
I believe cannabis can have psychedelic properties. I know that Rick Doblin, the executive director of MAPS, likes to include it. However, I haven't seen much evidence of people using cannabis in a psychotherapeutic framework or using cannabis to facilitate psychological growth, which remains long after the substance has left the body. It seems like the medical properties of cannabis are quite limited to the duration of the drug in the body. So, for example, to ameliorate pain. Even the people that really argue for the pain-reducing properties of cannabis would not say that cannabis can heal pain. They would say that it can reduce the pain. I guess in my definition of psychedelic, I want to be able to use the substance in a psychotherapeutic framework.
Right. Yeah. And so if we stick to the classic psychedelics that you mentioned there, how does the history look when it comes to scientific study of these compounds? And what have we brought with us from what we learned then into modern research and thinking about these substances?
Well, to begin with, it's important, I think, to recognize that these substances, these naturally occurring substances, have been used for thousands of years. I believe the earliest evidence of psilocybin mushroom use is about 10,000 years old. So these substances in the form of plants have been used to change consciousness, to heal disease, and for spiritual and ritual purposes in almost every culture. And some believe that they have played a role in the evolution of religion, but that is speculation.
Mm.
In Western culture, the use of psychedelics have been known for about 100 years. There were some experiments with mescaline in the 1920s, but we really discovered psychedelics on a big scale in the 1940s, when Albert Hofmann synthesized LSD by mistake or by chance.
He was that the guy? Was that, I'm just going to ask, was that the guy who, he took, what was it, 250 micrograms, thinking that that can't be anything, and then he biked home and had the bike ride of his life?
Well, it was a very rough bike ride. It was a very non-enjoyable experience, but that is the famous story, which is celebrated on Bicycle Day on April 19th every year.
Oh, that's great.
Albert Hofmann was working on synthesizing compounds from a fungus called ergot when he found LSD by mistake. And it was the 25th synthesis of this. He was systematically synthesizing different compounds in this fungus. And the now famous LSD was the 25th combination that he tried. So with Albert Hofmann, the field of psychedelic science and psychedelic psychiatry was born. The pharmaceutical company Sandoz, which is now known as Novartis, they marketed LSD and they distributed LSD to psychiatrists all over the world in a form of crowdsourcing or open sourcing research project. They said, if you're a psychiatrist, we will send you this new exciting substance as long as you report your findings back to us. So LSD was distributed all over the world, mainly in the Western world. And psychiatrists first called it a psychotomimetic because it seemed to be mimicking the effects of psychosis. And psychiatrists actually took this substance themselves to understand how it is to be psychotic, to understand schizophrenia. And it was believed that this new substance could perhaps hold the key to understanding the basis of and mechanism of schizophrenia. However, psychiatrists like Humphrey Osmond, who ran a very large mental hospital in Canada, in Saskatchewan, he noted that these experiences that people are having with LSD, they are very different from psychosis, in fact. And if you have a safe and calm setting, then people will have very, very beneficial experiences that seem to produce positive outcomes. He was giving this substance to alcoholics, and it became seen as the most promising development in psychiatry. During the 50s, over 1,000 scientific articles was produced on LSD-assisted psychotherapy, and over 40,000 patients in the U.S. were given this treatment for a wide range of conditions. And there was, I believe, 6 or 7 scientific international conferences. Wow. So this was seen as really a huge, very important development in psychiatry. And I can recommend Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, for a very interesting and thrilling account of that development. At the same time, as this substance was not regulated, this was before the regulation of any narcotics or any drugs, basically. People started using LSD outside of the lab, and it became associated with the first counterculture and the hippie movement. And this is commonly described as the reason for the end of the psychedelic research in the 50s and 60s. Right. That when Richard Nixon started the war on drugs, he prohibited these substances and it became forbidden to do scientific research with them. However, that's quite an oversimplification. And for those interested in this history, I can recommend a book by Matthew Oram, which goes deeper into exploring why psychedelic substances did not fit in the new scientific biomedical paradigm. But it's a little bit complicated, so I won't go into it now. But let's just say that psychedelic research was largely disbanded in the early 70s for a variety of reasons, of which some were political. The scientific data was very compelling, but by today's standards, it's quite poor methodology. There were some very high quality studies, randomized, placebo controlled, and then there's a lot of studies that were not well designed. Some studies where even the researchers took LSD with their subjects, and that research is, by today's standards, not worth very much. So that's some of the history.
Right. Yeah. No, I really like that attitude that you mentioned there of the therapist, him or herself, wanting to induce what was thought to be a psychotic state to simply become a better therapist. Because if you can empathize with what your patient is actually going through, it will be much easier to help them. So when did the modern research and the modern flame get kindled again? And basically, where are we today? What's going on currently?
So there was basically a 40-year hiatus on psychedelic research. It's worth mentioning what happened in the late 70s and the early 80s, which is that Alexander Shulgin discovered MDMA, or rediscovered MDMA, which he saw immediately. So Alexander Shulgin was a sort of a rogue chemist in California who tried to synthesize psychoactive compounds, basically. And he rediscovered MDMA and thought, this is a very good drug for doing therapy. And it was not regulated then because it was a novel or unknown compound. So it started to be used by psychiatrists in the US, mainly for couples therapy and also for treating trauma.
Mm.
And then it was once again started to be used outside of therapeutic settings, specifically in the rave scene of the 1980s. And then it was banned, just like the classical psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin. And in the 80s, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies was born, actually, as a result of the ban of MDMA, because MAPS, as they are called, have always been focused on researching MDMA in order to see how it can be used as a medicine. So you have MAPS working hard during the 90s, but not getting very far. At the same time, a professor in New Mexico called Rick Strassman got permission to do clinical research with DMT in the 90s, which was really unheard of, that it was actually possible to get approval from the FDA to give a psychedelic drug to people.
Why did they approve it?
I can't go into much detail, but I can highly recommend Rick Strassman's book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. The book is very different from the movie. The book is basically a detailed account of how he got approval to the studies with all the bureaucracy and university politics.
Right.
But this is important because other researchers read this book and draw the conclusion it's possible. We can get approval. And that's what sort of kindled the flame also at Johns Hopkins University in the early 2000s, when a professor called Roland Griffiths started thinking about reproducing or replicating an old experiment from the 60s, which is commonly referred to as the Good Friday experiment. And the Good Friday experiment was an experiment done by a fellow called Walter Pankey, who was both a priest and a psychiatrist. And he wanted to answer the simple question, if psilocybin can induce a mystical experience. such as it is known in the religious literature. So he gathered, I think, about 20 or 25 divinity students. That is, students who were going to be priests in Harvard University. And he gathered them during on Long Friday, on Good Friday, as it's called in English, in a chapel in Harvard University, in the basement. And he decided that half of them would get psilocybin, a high dose, and half of them would get placebo. And while there was a mass going on in the church, they would listen to this from the basement and get psilocybin. And they had very profound religious experiences. Mm. However, this study had its methodological flaws. So Roland Griffiths, in the early 2000s, he wanted to do a modern replication of this study. And he did, in a much more safe setting, not in a church, but in a psychotherapeutic framework, with preparatory sessions, with two experienced therapists as guides. And he did individual sessions with eye shades and with soothing music in headphones, which is also a framework which he borrowed from the early research with LSD-assisted psychotherapy. So these studies were published in 2006 and 2008, and they showed very clearly that this substance, psilocybin, that it can induce with high likelihood a mystical experience which gives a very strong sense of personal meaning that persists for years. So he asked his subjects to rate their psychedelic experience. How meaningful was it to them? And most of the subjects, I believe 80% of the subjects, believe that it was one of the most profoundly meaningful experiences of their life. And they compared it to the birth of a child or a marriage Wow. or death of a parent. So that got him thinking that this is something. And those studies had a huge impact and made researchers very interested in these compounds and thought maybe they can be used not just to give people a meaningful spiritual experience, but also to heal psychiatric disorders.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify, because you said that the majority, 80%, rated it as one of the most meaningful experiences of their life, and it had lasting effects for years there, or it remained very meaningful for years. So is that a claim that their lives were improved during those years, or what does that mean?
Yeah, well, of course, it depends on what you mean by improved, but they measured a range of different factors, including satisfaction from personal relationships and engagement Right. with community and a general feeling of well-being.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And was this the other, let's say, 20% that didn't report this, were there any incidents there of a profoundly negative experience that affected their lives negatively on these measures for years, or how did that look?
I can't really say what happened to the people who
they all died.
Did not claim this was one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives. But yeah. Generally in these studies, when employing the right safety measures, people do not have what is called a serious adverse event, which could be defined as a worsening of well-being over time, or, you know, psychiatric disorder.
Right. And so how, because that was around, what did you say, 2006, 2008?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a little over 10 years later then, where are we currently? How far have we progressed there? What's the so-called second wave of psychedelic research telling us so far?
So there's been a huge increase of interest, and there have been during the last years, there's just articles coming out every month from universities in most countries in the Western world. And there has been mainly small pilot studies with 10 to 20 patients to try and see, could psilocybin or other psychedelic compounds be effective for this specific patient group? Depression, existential distress, alcohol dependence, tobacco dependence. So what is called pilot studies or feasibility studies. And the results are overwhelmingly positive with very strong effect sizes compared to what you would see with other pharmacological interventions or psychotherapy. So they're small studies, and what they're basically saying is this is very promising, but we need to do much larger studies in order to draw certain conclusions with regards to how effective is it. But what we can say is basically that these interventions are safe and they're very promising.
That's interesting, because I want to discuss the potential side effects and risks, both in the therapeutic setting, but also outside of it a little later. So I'll plant a flag there. And I thought maybe we could start now when we have a good overview of what psychedelic substances are, how they came about, how they were used, and maybe go into what modern psychedelic psychotherapy actually looks like. So yeah, how does these trials look like when you're administered one of these substances?
So when I mentioned the safe setting,
yeah,
some would refer to that as psychedelic psychotherapy, involving a few preparation sessions where you, as a client or a patient, meet with the therapists, and you have the whole procedure explained, and you establish rapport or trust with the therapists. You set an intention, and you have the opportunity to ask any questions that you might have about this experience, which for most people is very different from anything they have ever experienced before.
Yeah.
So that's what is called as the preparation phase. And then you have the dosing session or sessions, which typically takes place in a hospital or in a psychotherapy setting, in a comfortable room with a bed or a couch and nice lighting, and music, which is calming but also brings out emotions. Typically, it has been classical music, ambient music, quite suggestive music. And these playlists are available on Spotify, by the way. So I highly recommend people interested in the music to check out a researcher and entrepreneur called Mendel Kalin, who works a lot with researching music and that whole aspect of psychedelic therapy. The dosing session takes place during typically 5 to 8 hours. And during this session, the therapists are quite passive and encouraging the client to go within and to just observe what is happening and try to let go of any fears that might come up or urge to control the inner experience. So just to let go. A common instruction for these sessions is to trust the process and let go of any any fear or ideas of how things should be, and try to be open to whatever comes up. Every psychedelic session is different, because what shapes the experience is what is within the person in question. A psychedelic experience acts as a non-specific amplifier. It amplifies anything that is inside. And in psychodynamic terms, you could say that it opens up the door to the subconscious or to the unconscious.
Yeah.
Much like a dream, really. But it can be quite a lot more vivid and seem very real. In fact, that is one of the criterias for a mystical experience, to have the sense that you are experiencing something that is realer than real, the ultimate reality.
And that's something I want to dive deeper into later, because I find that to be there are potential problems with that as well. But please continue.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of patients in these dosing sessions have anxiety, paranoia, and uncomfortable sensations. And that is seen as a part of the process and something to be explored. But of course, panic and paranoia is something that needs to be taken care of by professionals who know what they're doing. Right. So that's also why this safety protocol is so important.
So what would be an example of a common way? Because I guess one way of calming that down could be to dose with a benzodiazepine, like diazepam or something. But what would be a therapeutic technique that therapists might apply in a situation like that?
So typically, medications like benzodiazepines are kept on hand for emergencies, but almost never used.
Right.
Because the psychotherapeutic soothing techniques often go a long way. And it's quite simple, really, to be a safe presence and ensure the client that they are not going insane and they're having an experience. They have taken a drug, right, and this and this experience will end. We use grounding techniques like holding the hand, encouraging the client directly or indirectly to breathe slowly with diaphragmic breathing, which is typically instructed before. And the client also has the option of taking off the eye shades and taking off the headphones if the experience becomes too intense.
Right. So essentially, the therapist's job there is to act as a safe and compassionate anchor to the real world, so to speak, or the normal realm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the dosing session. And then there is the follow-up sessions, which center around debriefing. It's a place for the client to explore their own experience, which is often perceived as ineffable or impossible to describe in words, by still trying to put words on it. And I believe that's very important, to be able to put words on something in order to integrate it or to understand what it means for the person. And to, like I mentioned before, to take those psychological insights and make real world behavior changes.
Yeah. So can I just ask, if during the actual dosing session, then the patient is encouraged not to try to make sense of everything and understand and put labels on it, but actually just, like you mentioned, surrender to the experience. And it's not until in the aftermath where integrating it into the verbal reality of everyday life is encouraged.
Yeah, that's about right. And that framework, which I just described, could be called a non-specific support or psychotherapy. Mm. I think it's useful to refer to as more as non-specific support, because I believe that therapy is something much more long-term, where the therapist has a more active role in describing and guiding the client. But in psychedelic research today, there's not a whole lot of emphasis on the psychotherapy, because we are mostly doing very basic studies trying to answer the question, is this feasible? Does this work? And then a later question is, how can we research different psychotherapeutic frameworks in order to make these changes last, in order to make the very most out of this therapeutic tool? And one framework that is being, that is getting a lot of attention right now is ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy, which I think is a very useful therapeutic framework for psychedelic therapy.
Would you say that that is, or at least employs, elements of what's popularly called mindfulness meditation today, a way of learning to become very aware of all the phenomenology of your experience and experiencing it without valuing certain parts as good or bad, pushing them, trying to hold on to them, and rather just learning to see it as that fleeting experience that comes and goes?
Yeah, so mindfulness is a central practice and aspect of ACT, related to several of the core processes in ACT. One being the process of acceptance, or experiential avoidance, which is the sort of maladaptive side of that process. So just to give a brief example, as humans, we tend to want to avoid unpleasant experiences. And we avoid in many different ways on a cognitive level and a behavioral level as well. And in ACT, the client is encouraged through a variety of different techniques and metaphors to be more present with whatever is coming up.
Yeah.
And try to, instead of avoiding unpleasant sensations, to live life in a meaningful and valued way. And this is a process where mindfulness is very useful, and where I also believe that a psychedelic experience can be very useful, because in a psychedelic experience, most people struggle with the process of letting go of control. Mm. And what is inevitably happening in a sufficiently high dose of psilocybin is that you can't control it. It's impossible.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I think something that many people resist when it comes to the idea of accepting whatever comes up in experience is, I suppose this can apply both to the actual psychedelic session, but also in life in general, that if I accept the negative, as it were, sensations or feelings, I can't do anything about them. Whereas I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that ACT would stress that the best way to actually, let's say you have a knee that hurts, the best way to actually find a way out of that, if you want to get rid of the pain, is to learn to accept where you are right now, which is a state where the pain is there. And resisting it won't help you in actually trying to solve the problem. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, more or less. Then, of course, you have to, if you have a pain in your knee, you might have to assess, is it better to rest, or yes, shall I focus on living my life fully? And maybe that involves going to the gym.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And secondly, I think there's acceptance. The idea of accepting is somewhat paradoxical in that if you are in a state where you're trying to accept something, you are by definition not accepting it, because then you wouldn't have to try. And I find that interesting. I completely understand the sentiment, and I think it's very important and valuable. But accepting seems to be something that's binary. Either you have accepted it, in which case it's not an issue, or you're struggling to accept it, in which case you are failing to do so.
I believe it's more difficult to accept something than a lot of people think. I believe accepting something involves accepting all aspects of an unpleasant state. It also means accepting the emotions that come up with in relation to your painful knee. It means accepting the judgmental thoughts that you're having with regards to going or not going to the gym. And I think people often feel like accepting something is the same thing as giving up, like, yes, not doing anything about the hurt knee. But the key, I think, to acceptance is to be able to really experience the pain in the knee fully. And allowing it to be there, and living your life in a meaningful way.
No, absolutely. All right. So I want to go into a little more detail for some of the determining factors for success here. You've already mentioned the classically known idea of set and setting, but I would love if you could explicate that a little more. What do people talk about in the context of psychedelics when they refer to set and setting?
Sure thing. So when people talk about set and setting, set involves the mindset of the person. That is, all the psychological aspects that are brought into a psychedelic experience. So that might be intention. It might be a specific expectation or fear or, you know, hope. It involves the psychological state of the person. Did they sleep or did they eat before? So all these factors are very important. And in psychedelic therapy, priming is also important. That's something that happens in the preparation sessions, where you, for example, prepare the patient that this might be frightening, but that's fine, you know? Mm. So that when the person is expecting a difficult and healing experience, that is also something that plays into the experiential avoidance and acceptance process.
Yeah,
that something can be very, very difficult and at the same time be very important. So that's set. And then setting is the physical environment, but also the cultural environment. So the set and setting are partially overlapping, of course, because culture plays into expectations, which is set. But the most important or and most concrete way to describe setting is the physical surrounding. If there is other people, or if the person is lonely, if the state of other people, is it a therapist or is it a random person on the street?
Yeah.
And the music, of course, is a very important factor in the setting. Psychedelic therapy is typically called a non-directive form of therapy because the therapists are not during the session providing any guidance or cues.
Right.
However, Mendel Kaelin would say that the music is directive. The music is leading the client into different emotional states.
Let's explore that a little more, because I think Mendel Kaelin, he is responsible for Wave Paths, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
I've been using the online service there of some generative supportive music that's supposed to hold you in a nice way to direct you through an experience like that. And I'm curious then, firstly, how the music is chosen, seeing how every individual has their own unique problem situation and inner culture and likes and dislikes. And it seems like an extremely, almost impossible task to choose directive music that would suit everyone involved there. And then secondly, I'm thinking, I see how it can be useful in holding your hand through this experience metaphorically, but couldn't it go the other way as well and take away from where your mind would have gone and perhaps should have gone if you didn't have the music there in the first place to nudge you in a certain direction?
So music has a long history of use with psychedelics, and traditionally shamans would play music or sing or make different sounds to influence the journey and to prime and cue the person. And in modern settings, in psychotherapeutic settings and in psychiatry, typically different playlists have been used. And in modern research, these playlists have a certain order that corresponds with the intensity of the experience. So you would have very calm music in the beginning to assist through the initial anxiety which comes up. And then as the peak of the drug effects have been reached, then the music would take a bit more emotional and intense direction. The music has in research often been set in fixed playlists, because the therapists that are just working in research typically don't have time to change the music, and this is also a confounding factor in research. We can't really expect modern researchers to be DJs in the same way that shamans have been, or that, you know, underground therapists might work today.
Yeah.
Mendel Kaelin would say that these playlists do a decent job, but that some patients have negative experiences with the music that might actually have a negative impact on the outcome. When the music is just happens to be completely wrong with regards to where the person is in their process. There are different aspects to this. You could, of course, see it as an opportunity to accept and let go of that uncomfortable feeling with regards to the music. But I think, and Mendel Kaling think, that there is a lot to gain from giving the therapist some influence of the music. And this, of course, creates some problems with regards to research methods. But I believe that just like it's necessary to explore new avenues of psychotherapy, it's important to really explore how the music can be used to maximize or to increase patient outcomes.
So essentially, the patient will have some autonomy over whether they should listen to the music or not, or are they always encouraged to keep the music on, even if they don't want to? Or
in research today, typically patients are encouraged to stay with the music, but if they really dislike it, let us know and we'll change the track.
Yeah.
But it might be done once in a session, typically not several times.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm reminded of, you mentioned in the beginning, How to Change Your Mind, the book with Michael Pollan. And in one of his recollections of a underground psilocybin ceremony, I remember him saying that the guide played some new age spa-like music for him that he hated, and he argued with her to change it to classical music, which changed his experience dramatically. But so another thing in a similar vein here is the dose that is chosen, and I guess this could be generalized to not only psilocybin, but also LSD and other similar compounds. But let's talk about psilocybin here. So the dose, is it, from what I have gleaned from the research, it seems to say that starting low and then increasing over many sessions is the safest manner that leads to the best long-term outcome in well-being. Whereas there seems to be the idea that if you take too low of a dose, can be even worse than taking a really high dose because of what we talked before, the controlling element, the sense that you are still there, being able to steer the experience. Once you reach a certain threshold, you lose that ability, and that can actually be helpful because the pain is often in the resisting element. So how do you view dosaging here? Is it better to go on the higher end, or is how do you look at that?
So I would say that it's very different if you're talking in a medical framework or in a recreational situation or setting.
Right.
When we talk about recreational use or what people are doing in their own homes in their own time, I would say that the most important thing is to reduce harms. So it's to not take any risks. And the risk can be to take a dose that is too high, which creates a panic response or risky behaviors or a re-traumatization deep psychological trauma comes up, which you do not have the support or the ability to handle. So from a harm reduction perspective, I would say that it's best to start very low and to carefully go higher in dose. In the medical framework, we know which dose work best, because those kind of studies have been done, and we can guarantee that the psilocybin is pure, that it has not been tampered with in any way, and we can ensure a safe container. And then I would say that the most promising avenue is to go on a pretty high dose straight away.
So what is the dose that is considered, like you said there, that we know is the best for psilocybin, for instance?
With psilocybin, It's always synthetic psilocybin in the research. What has been found is doses between 21 and 29 milligrams of pure psilocybin. A very common dosage is 25 milligrams, which if you translate it into dried psilocybin cubensis, then it's somewhere between 4 and 4.5 gram of dried mushroom. So that's what I would call a very high dose. I wouldn't recommend. I wouldn't recommend anyone to take psilocybin in a non-clinical setting. But if someone were to take psilocybin in a recreational setting, I would tell them to start with a much lower dose, like 1 gram of dried mushroom.
I don't know if this comparison makes sense to make, but as far as I understand, the effects of LSD and psilocybin are fairly similar in character, with some differences, of course. But in general, the experience can be comparable. So what would you say? You said about four grams of cubensis dried. What would that be in terms of LSD? Would it be 170 micrograms, 150?
I really don't know. I don't want to say anything because I might be wrong.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. We're wrong a lot on this podcast. Is LSD used in similar context, or is it problematic? Because I understand that it's a much longer duration of the trip that might make it more difficult. Or what's the main reason that psilocybin is primarily used?
Well, like you say, it's largely a question of the duration of the experience. It's not feasible to have a researchers doing 12 to 16 hour shifts when sure. when you have the option of psilocybin, which is half that.
Yeah.
When I say 12 to 16 hours, that's of course with some extra safety, because the duration of LSD is not necessarily that long. It's more like 8 to 12 hours. But that translates into a very long working day. Yeah. The other reason for psilocybin being more common than LSD is that LSD has a strong political baggage. So researchers have believed, perhaps rightfully, that it's easier to get approval for a psilocybin study than an LSD study. Apart from that, there are some differences. LSD acts actually on several receptors, not only 5-HT2A. It also acts on dopamine and noradrenaline, which may be the reason why more paranoia can come through in an LSD trip. So psilocybin has generally a more favorable safety profile as well, although we don't know really the full potential of LSD. It might be that LSD with its longer duration is more effective for some people or some indications. In Switzerland, a doctor called Peter Gasser is using LSD a lot in what he calls psycholytic therapy, which involves a lower dose but more repeated dosing, where the psychedelic experience is, well, you do a lower dose so it's still possible to talk and the ego is not completely dissolved. People do not have a mystical experience on these lower doses. So it's seen more as a lubricant to the regular psychotherapy, which often goes for months. And it's a quite promising avenue of research. So I hope we get to see more LSD research soon.
Right. And so it's more of aching to normal psychotherapy with a chemical lubricant, as you put it, rather than the overwhelm of the mystical experience doing some work there without the interaction, the direct interaction with the therapist.
That's right.
Yeah. So when you say lower doses there, do you have any indication of what constitutes a lower dose?
I believe that what they are using in psycholytic therapy is 50 to 100 micrograms.
Right. Yeah, okay. So I want to talk about the potential risks and side effects of using these compounds and what's colloquially known as a bad trip, quote unquote. I know many people insist on contextualizing them as challenging trips, rather, because as you said before, something very good can come of a challenging trip if treated rightly and integrated correctly. But there's also something to be said for why people would call them bad trips, because as you said there, they can induce very strong states of fear and paranoia and panic. And I thought we could just go over the most dangerous offenders here. So psychosis has been used a lot politically to demonize these compounds. And as far as what I've been able to look up before we spoke today, there hasn't been any long-term cases of psychotic breaks on these compounds in a clinical setting if vetted correctly for close relatives. I think it's first degree relatives, maybe, for schizophrenia and other mental illnesses. But what do we know about the relationship between psychosis and the use of psychedelics?
Not much.
Right.
because we haven't done any modern research when people with psychosis or psychotic tendencies are given psychedelics. And I don't think we're going to see that research anytime soon. What we do know is that some people who have a predisposition for psychosis, including siblings or relatives with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, are at higher risk for having a psychotic episode triggered that lasts for days or weeks after the effects of the drug have gone out. So for this reason, people with psychotic history of psychosis or siblings with these tendencies are excluded from modern psychedelic research. There is, however, old studies showing that some patients with schizophrenia can be helped by these substances. So I think we know so little about psychosis in general, so it's difficult to say how psychedelics affect people with psychosis. There is a researcher called Benjamin Mudge who does research with ayahuasca, and he claims that certain brews of ayahuasca with certain chemical composition may help people with bipolar disorder, whereas other brews might trigger a manic episode.
Mm.
We do know that in population studies, survey studies with hundreds of thousands of people responding, the incidence of psychosis is not higher in people who use psychedelics than the general population.
Which is not the case for cannabis, where there's a much stronger correlation.
That's right. So the risk is there. And if a client came to me and said, my uncle has schizophrenia, or my mother is bipolar, I would strongly advise them to not have a psychedelic experience. But I don't know how big the risk is. And I don't think anyone really does.
No, that's fair. So how about this phenomena called HPPD, which I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's a visual tinnitus, you could say, of lasting distortions in your visual field after an experience like this. What do we know of HPPD when using these substances?
So I think the full name is hallucinogen persisting perception disorder. Yeah. And it's very uncommon. It seems to mainly affect people who have comorbid psychiatric disorder and a history of trauma or substance abuse. However, it is a real thing, and it's definitely something that needs to be studied more. It's also seen in chronic users of psychedelics rather than one time or a few time use. And it's never been observed in a clinical study. So it's a risk, but I wouldn't say that it's one of the most important risks to keep in mind. I would say that the most important risks of using psychedelics is the potential for a traumatic experience or a traumatization, which might lead to more anxiety or a PTSD-like state, where something that has happened in a individual's life has greatly affected that person and led to the forming of different coping responses and basically structures of experiential avoidance that helps the person live their day-to-day life in a way that sort of works, but not really.
Yeah.
A psychedelic experience, especially in a unsupervised setting with not enough support, could be not just very unpleasant, but lead this person into anxiety, depression, and a worsening of psychiatric health in general. That person might then go into the psychiatric system and be put on a variety of pharmaceutical drugs. So that's the main risk that I see.
Right. Yeah, and it's important to talk openly about these risks as well, because as I said in the beginning there's we're in kind of a golden era right now where psychedelics is very in vogue and it's a rekindled interest in research, and there are all these potential benefits when used properly and treated with respect for the powerful tools that they are. But like with many other things, there's an air of hyperbole around it, especially for people who have had a great experience and hence ends up preaching that everyone should try this. Grandma, mom, my brother. So I'm curious, what can we confidently say at the moment that we know about psychedelics and their use? And what are some hyperbolic claims and false claims that we can't stand behind at this point? Misconceptions.
I'll have to think about that. I mean, what we can safely say about psychedelics is that they induce this hyperplastic state, which creates opportunities for learning. And that's also true for a traumatic event, that it's a hyperplastic state which leads to learning of new ways of being in the world. A psychedelic experience, much like a near-death experience or a severe trauma, challenges everything we think we know about the world. So we know that psychedelics are very powerful tools that can be used to heal and that can be also very risky or dangerous on a psychological and or spiritual level.
Yeah.
I think part of the hyperbole around psychedelics is the same as the hyperbole for different spiritual paths or traditions. People automatically think that they are more wise or enlightened because they have had this experience. And there is a risk there to confuse what you have experienced with, you know, what someone else might experience. So to not be humble, I guess. Yeah, and then, of course, on a more medical level, there is often an expectation that psychedelics can cure all kinds of physical ailments. And some of it may be true, but I think that the placebo effect is extremely powerful with psychedelics, and that's part of it. But it's important to know really the implications of set and setting so that we can use these medicines wisely and still not be confused of the nature of reality.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's what I wanted to hit on next, because I would call myself a mystical rationalist. So I'm very interested personally in different states of consciousness and introspection. And I think there's a lot to be learned here, but it's also just a case that this podcast is based around the field of epistemology, or the theory of knowledge, how we learn, how we create knowledge in the world. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with that field, but there's a mistaken idea called empiricism, which claims that we get knowledge through the senses. The senses and our sense experiences are the general source of our knowledge. And that has been forcefully refuted by the ideas of Karl Popper, who created critical rationalism and showed that knowledge is internally generated. And if we take modern neuroscience today, we know that the brain doesn't have any direct access to the world around us. The brain is encapsulated in a dark skull, and through the sense organs receives weak electrical signals that it then has to interpret to generate the VR experience of the world that you experience as the world. And so I think a danger here, if you don't understand that that's actually what's going on and that your experience is completely determined by the interpretory structures and ideas that you have, it can be dangerous to have an experience, as you alluded to in the beginning, and then think that you have seen some ultimate truth or experience some ultimate truth of reality that is more real than your everyday experience, and not understand that that is also an interpretation. You're changing the neurochemistry and effectively playing around with the interpretations that your brain makes. But that doesn't give you any direct access to any truth or something like meaning, feeling that something is immensely meaningful. If my mom, who's a devoted Christian, just like the people in the study you mentioned with religious experience there, she will contextualize a really strong sense of meaning and love as experiencing the love of God, or she met Jesus, or whatever her previous theoretical framework allows her to make of this experience, whereas I would probably not make that jump. And it can be the same phenomenology, but the conclusion we make from those experiences might be completely different. And I think it's very important to keep that humility there, that it doesn't mean that just because you felt like you were one with everything in the universe, that metaphysically, that is the best explanation we have. And I was wondering what you think about, for instance, claims about we're all one, or that consciousness is something bigger than you. And when you have an ego dissolvement experience, you can feel like, yeah, you're becoming unified with something greater. And I think that that is a part of why people with existential angst and death anxiety have felt much better about their condition, because they think they're actually going to live on as something greater after they die. And I'm wondering where you think, firstly, what you think of this whole monologue of mine here in general, but also what you think of the idea that, yeah, should we be so quick to make the, is it good to delude yourself to feel better? Where, what should we make of these experiences? Is it good to feel better from the experience, even if it's because of a false idea? Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I am not very into epistemology. I have not read a lot on that topic. I really appreciated the way you put it. I thought it was very, very easy to understand and also compelling. I guess where I stand on this is a very pragmatic perspective. I think that we don't know what the hell is going on. And we may never do, because we are just equipped with this prediction machine, which has evolved over thousands of years to serve us with workable VR experience, as you put it. And I think the most important thing is to find, I guess, workable models and live a meaningful life with those models, but at the same time be aware that it is only a model. It's just like a map that works.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that you know exactly what the terrain looks like, to use a common metaphor.
Yes. That's a very important point. And I think that, and I'm biased here, just as anyone else, but I'm biased because I have a very difficult time with the lofty claims often made by religion or even the field of a quote unquote spirituality. I have issues with, either, even though I would consider myself, I don't have a better word for it, but I ponder the mystery of the universe probably more than most people. And I think that a mistake that, and I use religion here because it's the perfect example of what I'm against, which is dogmatism in all of its forms. It's the idea that you have the ultimate truth in hand. And an argument I often hear from people of religion is that, oh, but you're so close-minded, Christopher. You could just open your mind to the Bible or Jesus or whatever it is. And that makes me furious, because in my head, there's nothing less humble and open-minded to just blindly believe that we already have the ultimate truth, even more so that it's written in a book by the Almighty Creator. And I don't mean to in any way discredit people who are religious. I love people in general, and it's fine to believe whatever you want. But I'm criticizing the ideas here, just to clarify. But to me, science is built on curiosity, on open-mindedness, on the idea that we can always be wrong. What's called fallibilism within epistemology. We can never get to the ultimate truth. We're using models, as you say, and science is the procedure of actively improving on these models by correcting the errors in them, but always being open to criticism and improvement. And to me, the idea that, to take it back to psychedelic experience, that, oh, but this was so immensely beautiful and expansive, and my mind couldn't have done that. my brain couldn't have done that. It must have been something else. I think that's denigrating your brain. I think that when people say, oh, so you think it's just your brain? What do you mean, just my brain? My brain is the most amazing object that's ever been created in the universe. And when you have all these experiences of unity and love and bliss, I think they are real. The experience is real. But I think you are belittling your mind if you think that you need an outside source to attribute that to, rather than you restricting your own mind most of your waking time and not seeing that you have unlimited creative potential within yourself, which I think is a very beautiful, I would say a more beautiful sentiment in my mind. And you don't have to adopt any dogma or close yourself off to any future creation of new knowledge by adopting that.
I think I agree with most of what you say. I keep thinking of I've been reading Yuval Noah Harari lately.
All right.
And his description of or his definition of religion and science alike as ideologies designed to provide answers one way or another, and then spirituality in its most basic sense being this path of not knowing, what you might refer to as mysticism. And that doesn't mean that I think science is the best tool we have to find out what is actually true. However, if it is often mistaken for believing that we have the answers.
Yes, which would be scientism, and that's equally bad. I'm with you on that. But so how do you view then, just for fun, because I think that people talk about, for instance, Mother Ayahuasca or the mushroom as being its own entity somehow, whereas I would, like I alluded to there, I would say that it's mechanical in the sense that you're changing. The only thing it does, it's changing your neurochemistry and allowing your own mind to do things that it was always possible to do. But the drug is the facilitator, but it's always your mind that's creating all the beautiful and amazing stuff that's going on there. Would you dispute that? Are you more inclined towards the Mother Ayahuasca, the other entity sort of thing, where the drug itself is a creative entity? Or where do you stand on that?
I guess I take the diplomatic stance of I don't know, and whatever works. I think for people who have a very strong experience of a separate entity, such as the experience of Mother Ayahuasca, mm-hmm. there is a reason why they have that experience, and that reason might just be that it is something that their mind generated because it's helpful for them. But I would still see that as part of that person's process.
Mm. But do you think it's possible, do you think it's necessary in a situation like that to interpret that metaphysically as, yes, there is some other entity guiding me, rather than maybe understanding that it was symbolically created by your mind to make you realize something?
I guess where I am as a clinician and as a therapist, I don't really make metaphysical claims. I don't have to, I think. So I refrain from it, just because it would be more difficult for me to discuss these experiences with patients if I at the same time took a solid stance and said, you know, this is great that you're experiencing Mother Ayahuasca, go with that. By the way, it's not true.
Yeah, what a shitty therapist. Huh?
And for my for myself as well, I tried to stay agnostic. I think I used to call myself an atheist, but now I think that the only thing that really makes sense is to stick with uncertainty and sort of explore that.
Yeah, I mean, I like your humility here. I tend to be a person who adopts the maxim of strong opinions loosely held, because I think that the best way to make progress is to push ideas hard and be willing to, at any juncture, once you hear better arguments, let it go. But atheism is an interesting thing because it doesn't make sense at all to me. I think that all the current arguments we have and explanations for why there must be a God are bad, and they can be refuted. So you don't have to, I don't think you have to take a position. Atheism is a stated position that there is no God. And I suppose this might be what you mean with taking the agnostic position here, that, yeah, we just don't know. But I would say that even that would be unnecessary, in the sense that, yeah, I don't think there are any good arguments for why there's a God, so I don't walk around thinking there's a God. But I'm open to it as soon as we have some reason to think that should change. So I would suppose that that's kind of what you mean, right, by being agnostic?
Yeah.
All right. But yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I think it's equally bad when people become numb to the fact that we know so little. Science is a few hundred years old, and it's created a lot of progress so far, and I'm very, very grateful for it. But we're always going to be, I don't know if you've read the book, The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch, a Oxford physicist I had on the podcast. But the basic idea there is that we will always be at the beginning of infinity when it comes to our ignorance, because there's all our knowledge is internally created. It's guesswork, and all we can do is correct errors in our faulty models, but we'll never be able to reach some ultimate truth there. And that means that there's no bounds to how much progress we can make. We can make infinite progress. And to me, that is just as baffling and mind-expanding and wonderful as any religion. So I think there's still room for that mystical wonder, even if one is sympathetic to science and reason.
I think that sounds beautiful. I haven't read his book. I'll start by listening to that episode.
Yes, I would very much encourage it. It's what prompted this podcast to begin with. So, yeah, I want to touch on what you do in your practice with psychedelic integration, and more generally, why it's so important and what it means. But we haven't really touched on the mechanism or the hypothesized mechanism behind what the psychedelic experience is doing. So what do you consider the best explanation we have today of what it is that the psychedelics are doing to us?
Well, you can look at it on several different levels. I mean, there's the neuroscience mechanism, and then there's psychological mechanisms. I'm more comfortable with psychology, as I'm a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I will quickly mention that psychedelics disrupt a network in the brain called the default mode network, which seems to correlate roughly with the sense of me, or the ego, you could say. And as that network is disrupted in the brain, parts of the brain that don't usually communicate or fire together or talk with each other start communicating. So the brain becomes enters this more flexible or plastic state, which can be described also as an orchestra without the conductor.
Yes.
So an orchestra that is playing more in a more like a cacophony, which allows for new insights and new pathways in the brain and new synapses to grow. On a more psychological level, I think an important mechanism is this inability to control one's own experience, which leads to new insights again and new thoughts and emotions that are typically suppressed for different reasons. Like I said, psychedelics amplify sensations in general, including emotions thoughts and sensations in the body.
Yeah.
In the modern research with depressed patients, a central proposed mechanism is the feeling of being connected to the self or to other people, or of being part of something bigger, which comes with, you know, some metaphysical claims, which may or may not be true, but seems to play a very important role in people's lives. I mean, you can't deny that we are social group animals that tend to depend on one another very much, and that for the last few hundred years, in Western society at least, have become more isolated from each other and removed from our natural habitat. So I think it brings people back to this more primal state, and connects people more to their central emotional needs and values, which I think most of the patients that I have met in my practice, and also from working in the public healthcare system, most people are not so connected to their own needs and values. They act more based on fears and what they believe that others expect of them, and try to follow this recipe for how you're supposed to live your life to be happy. But they are not happy, and they're not connected to their needs. And I think a psychedelic experience in the right conditions put people back in touch with what they really want or really need. So I would say that's a central psychological mechanism.
Yeah, so I mean, it definitely seems like there's a loosening of the filter between what gets to rise up to conscious awareness or not, for better or for worse. I mean, that's where, like you've mentioned, you can get material that is repressed for a reason, even if it's not serving you ultimately in the sense of having a repressed trauma that drives a lot of your behavior. You want to avoid that and avoid facing that, but it's repressed because you weren't able to process it in the context where it happened the first time. And so just releasing it willy-nilly might do more damage than good. So, but it also, I like the idea that restarting the default mode network, restarting the self model that we are identifying with all the time, people seem to, and in meditation circles, it's common to talk about how the self is an illusion, that the conscious representation of yourself is by definition a representation. It's a model of you that you're using to navigate the world. But if that model is too rigid and coercive in the sense that it's not... It has become a sort of dictator not allowing all the ideas and thoughts and feelings and sensations to be a part of your creative framework of you as a person, then it can be very beneficial to tear that down and essentially reset yourself, in the sense that I've teared down this armor that I've been carrying for so long with all these defense mechanisms, and I thought I was that armor. I thought I was those defenses and those negative thoughts and feelings, but in essence, they were just my best solutions to overwhelming problems. And there are other solutions that don't include me being limited by this representation, but rather using the representation to live life to the fullest instead of being imprisoned by it. And I think that psychedelics can really be a useful tool there. And I'm extremely excited that people like you have been furthering this new wave and really trying to show the world that the stigma around psychedelics as something universally bad is simply wrong. And there's so much more to learn about the mind and psychiatric illnesses and suffering that psychedelics can help us with. And so it's really cool, Philip, that you're doing this. I'm very happy to see that, and much praise.
Thank you. That's it's lovely to hear.
Yeah. And so I thought that I reached out on Twitter for some Twitter questions, and we got some good ones here. So I thought it'd be fun to end on that. But first, I just want to ask you about psychedelic integration then. Yeah, how does it look like in practice, usually, when you do it or when they do it in the studies? And yeah, why is it so important after an experience like this?
Psychedelic integration is important because the psychedelic experience itself can be so alien and so different from our life. And if you think about how psychedelics have been used through thousands of years, they have often been really integrated in a culture and in a ritual for how to, in a belief system, really. But now, because psychedelics is not part of our culture, and in fact, non-ordinary states of consciousness is routinely pathologized in our culture, it's difficult to translate these insights, or let's say the newfound connection with needs and values, into the way we live our world.
Mm.
At the same time, it is necessary, because if you have a very strong belief or value that is not in line with how you live your life, then you will have a very strong cognitive dissonance and psychological suffering as a result. An example, it could be a Wall Street banker who thinks that the most important thing in life is to make lots of money and to have praise and lots of material benefits and a beautiful wife, and he might go to the Amazon to have an ayahuasca experience and fundamentally change those beliefs. Now he might go back to his work as a Wall Street banker and feel that suddenly life is very meaningless, that money doesn't give that sense of reward anymore, and be utterly lost in that and not know what to do. So that's partly because, of course, that money is not actually directly satisfying any human needs. It's an indirect way to satisfy different human needs. So the question for integration then is, what are those needs, and how do you actually get what you need in this imperfect capitalist society? How can you make life work and feel like you're living in line with your values, and at the same time, you know, make money and put food on the table and pay rent?
Yes.
That is a huge challenge, I think. And you can't really, it's difficult to, you know, of course, address systematic issues in a one-on-one therapy session. But I think talking about it and exploring what kind of small changes can be made in your life is an important first step. And identifying those needs is an important first step. So that's one aspect of what I do in my private practice. But then there's also, on a much more basic level, consultation, where someone might be considering taking a psychedelic drug but is feeling uncertain with regards to their mental health, or trying to help a friend who is using psychedelics, where I might see someone for just a few times and help them find good information and make informed decisions. While I would never, of course, give someone a psychedelic substance or refer someone to a retreat, I have my experience and my knowledge to help people make good decisions, which might be to not take a psychedelic substance, of course.
Yeah. No, that's important. And I think that you're providing a very well-needed service here in Sweden, because as far as I know, there are not very many people who work with this the way you do. Am I right about that?
Yeah, not very many are doing it. But I have been during the last month starting a network of therapists that have experience working with psychedelics. So we're about 20 now, and on my to-do list is to set up a public list online so that people can better access these services all over the country. Especially, I think it's especially important as this hype in psychedelic science is really driving the underground scene, and we have ayahuasca ceremonies popping up everywhere, and some are doing it in a safe way, and some are doing it in a not safe way. So people are having very difficult experiences that need to be addressed somehow, that needs support.
Yeah, and I mean, in countries like America, it's much more widespread. And I know that having a culture here which is very much against any drug except for the legal ones like alcohol, it can be even worse here, I would imagine. And even more, it can be even more, you can feel even more alone and desperate because you have no way to turn. And there's no way to talk to someone because nobody understands why you would use that, and you can be demonized for having wanted to use it. And I think that's really cool. And I'm looking forward to that list. I think that will be a valuable tool. So I think it could be fun. I went out on Twitter here and asked for some questions. And so we got a few good ones. The first one was from someone who seemed interested in trying psychedelics. He said, for a risk-averse person like me, what is the safest way to begin experimenting with psychedelics? And we can put in the caveat there that in no way, shape, or form are either of us condoning the use of these illegal substances. This is all theoretical.
I think the most important thing for safety is to test the substance so that you know that you are taking what you intend to take. I would encourage anyone to read up on all of the risks. Then I would encourage to start with a very low dose and to involve a close friend or trusted person that might assist as a sober sitter.
Right. And the low doses, which you can step up successively, is that just to familiarize yourself with that psychedelic space and not overwhelm yourself?
Partly, and also because people that are traumatized might have a very strong reaction to a low dose.
Mm.
So there is a risk there for some individuals to have a very overwhelming experience even on a low dose.
That's interesting. Okay, so the next question is, have psychedelic therapy been used to treat anxiety disorders like GAD, social anxiety, hypochondria, etc.? Are there any specific compounds or practices that seem particularly promising?
Well, psychedelics have, there has been no clinical trials with any of the diagnosis that was mentioned as inclusion criteria, like generalized anxiety disorder or social phobia. There's one published study on social phobia in individuals with autism.
Hmm.
That's with MDMA, a study by Alicia Danforth that was published a few years ago. Then there is the studies from NYU and Johns Hopkins with existential distress in terminally ill patients. So there's people with anxiety there, but it's a certain type of anxiety in a very specific population.
Yeah.
In the studies where they have tested depressed patients, they have also measured anxiety, and there are in all studies a substantial effect on anxiety. So I think there's a good reason to believe that psychedelics could help with social phobia or generalized anxiety, but there has been nothing published on those indications yet.
Right. Yeah. This is a good one. What role do things like attachment and trust in other people, having a social circle to lean on, etc., play in the success of treatment, including integration? Would some people be better off working on these more practical life skills before undergoing psychedelic therapy?
Yes, I think so. There's not much research on this again. I recall one study which shows increased incidence of difficult experiences in people with high levels of neuroticism as a personality trait. Now, neuroticism is not itself attachment, but it is connected to what is ambivalent or avoiding attachment.
Yeah,
I believe that individuals who are traumatized, for them, it's necessary with more preparatory sessions, for example.
Right.
Or I should say that it would probably be necessary because, again, there's no research showing this. I know that in the studies with psilocybin for depression from Imperial College and other universities, they have seen that some people do not respond, and there seems to be some trauma, which in turn leads to trust issues, which makes it more difficult to let go and surrender to the experience. So I think I would love to see research on attachment and psychedelics, and I think such research will be going on soon. But there, yeah, there's a lot we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, which is so exciting. I mean, just imagine the coming decades here, provided something doesn't go very politically wrong here. So should we persuade friends and family to try psychedelics? It's an experience so unlike any other that I feel sympathy towards those that die without having it. Also, what's the biggest misconception that smart people have about them when giving reasons why they won't give it a try?
Well, I think it's several good questions. I think it's important not to try to persuade people to have a psychedelic experience in general. I think it's a risky decision that people need to make by themselves. And we don't know that a certain person might have a certain experience. It might be that an experience that was for, you know, person A was a life-changing positive experience, and for person A's brother might be a traumatic experience. So I think it's important to be very careful there. With regards to a common misconception made by smart people. When they say they won't use it. Jeez, I think... no, I don't know. I can't really answer that one.
Okay.
I was just just thinking of like things that I have heard in podcasts, but it's not really common. It's just, random things I've heard.
Right. So, but that could be interesting anyway, if you don't mind, with that caveat.
I guess their response that I am so out there anyway, I don't need psychedelics to be even more, you know, flexible in my thinking or creative.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess that could be valid. If you are a person who's feeling great and you don't have any creative blocks and you are compassionate and open and happy, then that might be the case for you, that you actually don't need it. But I think many people would be surprised at how rigid they are and what can be experienced when taking something like a psychedelic.
Yeah, so that's why I wouldn't really call it a misconception, because it's just because I don't know the individuals. It's so difficult to say.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so I have a final question for you here. It's, what are some arguments for and against legalization of psychedelic drugs? Should these drugs exclusively be used for therapy, or should they be widely available?
That's a difficult question, because it depends so much on the, you know, the political, cultural context. And we don't know. I think the only way to figure it out is this like careful experimentation. I think that it's very important to have some form of controlled setting. Safe setting, and that might be within the medical system. It might be another framework, but I think in order for society to integrate these experiences, they need to be contained somehow. I see big problems with legalization in terms of commercialization, when capitalist interests take over, then the patients or individuals don't necessarily benefit from that.
Personally, I'm more of a libertarian when it comes to drugs. I think that in general, people should be free to put whatever they want in their bodies in their own home, as long as they're not damaging
someone else or ruining someone else. But it's an interesting point that you bring up there, the idea that we don't really have the cultural knowledge of how to integrate these things, how to use them in a smart way, in a way that's actually helpful. So I'm a little torn there. I don't think it would be great if everyone could buy it in the grocery stores tomorrow. I think it might lead to a lot of people just haphazardly trying it without taking the risks into consideration and giving it the respect it deserves. But then again, I do think that if people want to get a hold of these things, they will. I don't think the war on drugs is a successful approach in general, but that's a very big discussion for another time, I think, Philip. You have been extremely generous with your time, and I had a great time talking to you. I hope I get to talk to you again sometime.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I feel like the time went very quickly.
That's usually a good sign. And so, let's make 2021 a great year for psychedelics then.